On October 29, 2005, Nzinga Dugas was the closing keynote at the third annual Practical Activism Conference, Tools for Local and Global Change, held at UCSC in Santa Cruz, California. Nzinga Dugas is a 13-year staff member of UC Berkeley in the area of student services and development. Her primary areas of expertise include student leadership and development, outreach, recruitment, retention, and cross-cultural student coalition building. She has been active in supporting the student voice for 20 years and has been the keynote for student leadership programs, as well as doing trainings, seminars, and workshops focusing on leadership development.
So I want to just speak to a few of those people that we see every day, because I really believe that they carry the same torch we do. They just happen to do it in a different venue. So I like to look at people like Michael Eric Dyson, renowned academic and cultural agitator, and he probably got involved because he had to watch his father, who he considered a strong black man, being reduced to the notion of a boy in a very, very racist society. He had to learn, after struggling in his own church, after he became a minister, he kind of looked around and he didn't see any women who were ministers or pastors or anything like that. So he took on a campaign and he said, I want to create a space for women to be pastors and ministers, and was pushed out of his church. And then we have people like Malcolm X, who we all look to and we go, wow, look at the struggle that he had. But we know his path. He watched his father and his family suffer under the KKK. And so that's kind of how he got sparked. And then there's Tupac Shakur, and a lot of people are kind of confused about Tupac Shakur and his violent death, but he was in a cross struggle between freedom and then the ghetto. So freedom in the black community, as well as trying to struggle with the ravages of the ghetto. And then there's Yuri Kochiyama, who watched her family be interned right here in California, where she came under this notion of freedom, and her family thought they were going to live a new and a different life. And what do you know? She's being carted off to an intern camp and struggled for that for years. And then today we look at Cheryl Swoops deciding that she was tired of being quiet and hiding, and that a lesbian basketball player is a good basketball player, and in fact, the two are not mutually exclusive. And Rosa, may the ancestors carry her to peace, and Fanny were both just tired of the same old, and just stood up one day and said, I just can't do this anymore. And we see Cindy Sheehan. She's not a typical one of you out there. She happened to gain her role because she had no choice. I don't know if any of you who out there who are parents, but when you lose a child, you have no choice but to open up your voice and speak out. And finally, I just want to speak a little bit about Kanye West, because he's certainly not an iconic radical. There's some issues with his music and, you know, what's happening with him. But he saw the unspeakable and just repulsive after impacts of Hurricane Katrina. And his psychological anguish did not allow him to be quiet. And so he used his hip-hop, Bully Pope, to kind of speak what his anguish was. And the lesson there, folks, was that despite where you are in your own personal struggle and your beliefs and figuring out what you believe and how you're going to do what you're going to do, there's a moment in time that can shift your life. And it could be today, it could be next week, it could have happened already. And I just wanted to kind of make the correlation, because these prototypical leaders are no different from you and I. The work that you're doing right here is because something sparked you, something engaged you, something made you think that I don't want to do this anymore, this is not right, and I have to at least show my voice today. And so that's no different from where I was 20 years ago today. Like you today, there are common threads, I'm ashamed to say, that are still true. For example, and I just, if you guys just kind of give a nod, I don't know if you guys still have the persistence of the only one. You guys know what the only one syndrome is? It's I'm the only Latino or black, the only woman, the only person of color, and I have to represent everyone because I'm the only one in this damn class. And that's a shame that in 2005 we're still hearing, I am the only one. And in 2005, at some of the UCs, I won't say any names, students of color still have to be in large lectures and looking around and finding that they're the only one. And no one wants to be in a group study session with them because they don't believe that they're academically strong. And in 2005, we're dealing with this. So that, it was those kind of things that sparked my involvement just in student politics at San Francisco State. It was the notoriously bad press that people of color always get. It's like we seem to be on the front page, and all of us appear to look like that image of OJ, right, on the front page. And we got tired of seeing that. And we just got tired of feeling that the only place that I could find some sanctuary, some peace, was in ethnic studies or in women's studies or in my own student group office, that anywhere I went on campus, I couldn't find a place of peace or somebody who was talking about me or my issues or things that I was dealing with. That in 1980, just as there is today, there were a minority of students on campus. That it is a shame that in 2005 at UC Berkeley, there are 2.8% of African American students. And that when we look 20 years ago, it was the same thing and it was the same struggle. So getting active became similar to breathing. If I was gonna breathe, then I had to do something about what we were dealing with. And so as we were going through it, each day as we were dealing with some of the things in our classroom, as we were struggling with the different situations, we began to just step back and say, how do we organize? I mean, me coming from a family of nine brothers and sisters, pretty sheltered, pretty shy, pretty covered up by my family, my brothers and sisters, we began to sit down and talk about this thing of organizing and how do we organize and how do we make a difference? Because we felt like when we walked out of that university, we wanted to make sure they understood that, yes, students can make a change. And usually it is students and young folks who spark other folks in their comfort zones to make a change. And so we began to figure out, first of all, how do we understand what organizing means? And through practice, and through talking to our elders and then looking at other struggles, we understood, and this is something I told Ray, that sometimes as progressive folks, as people of color, we don't understand that organizing also means winning. It absolutely means winning. It means first creating a strategy, and that strategy is for the purpose of winning. Now, how do you do that? You first start with, you have to do internal building. That's critical to any organizing that you're doing. So the first thing we did was we began to internally build in our own organization. And then we started getting like organizations, people who had similar issues, whether that was METCHA, whether that was RASA, whether that was the Native American Students Association. We pulled them all together and we said, what do we have like? What is similar? What are we dealing with? And then we began to say, let's start training ourselves and developing ourselves on how do we do this thing called organization. Because we were clear about things like what Gandhi said, because when you start organizing, you'll find that, as he said, first they ignore you because they don't think you have the ability to organize and to pull a group of folks together like this. Then he said, then they'll laugh at you. And when they find that doesn't work, they'll get a little scared, and then they'll begin to fight you. And then after that, then you win. So see, creating a strategy has the ultimate goal of winning, and I think we got that. We understood that. We understood that the end goal didn't mean struggle and pulling out our hair and all this other stuff. It meant whatever we were struggling for, we were bound to win. And so we started to say, okay, what is our role? Because everybody has to play a different and significant role. No role is insignificant. You have to figure out who's the lead team versus the executive team versus a general member. Some folks are raising kids, so they can't be on the lead team. And so you can't lean on them to do the work. They may have to do some other work. They may be the secretary in the office who are making copies for you, right? Where you're getting free copies or however you're doing what you're doing. You have to kind of figure out what important role must each person play. Then one of the lessons that we learned is we had to understand the difference between a coalition and an alliance. And a coalition is something temporary because you have to look at what are your fundamental things that you believe in and how can you organize around those, because you're not going to agree with everything. I mean, certainly if you look in certain areas like the Black church, for example, they had specific things that we didn't necessarily agree with, but they had a whole bunch of things that we did agree with. So we organized on those things, and we understood that that was a temporary union, that we were not going to be in this for the long haul, but we needed numbers. You have to understand that an alliance is more long term. And so alliance is something that you can build on and that this is a fundamental value and you all agree on those values. And so we had to understand the difference so we didn't get our feelings hurt, right? Because a lot of times we go, oh, I thought you had my back. But we weren't clear going in who did and who didn't have our back. So we got really clear about that. And then we understood that we had to select an issue and build a platform on that issue, right? A lot of times we'll go, okay, we're going to take on all these issues. Well, we know that if we do that, that can distract us. There's too many things going on, and our focus is all over the place. But we took so many issues, and we stood on three issues, and that was our platform. And we fought that all the way to the end until we got most of what we wanted. And then we built a platform first on our campus because we first have to get all of us on the same page. Then we start going out to the community. And a lot of times we forget that. We forget that the work that we're doing is for the folks out there, is the folks who can't do it. So we start going out to the community. We start going out to the NAACPs and to the unions, to other folks, and say, how can we kind of build a coalition? And then we start going statewide and start building a statewide collective. And then they got scared, right? And they said, okay, these folks are serious. And then we start going nationwide. We said, okay, but we did that systematically. Once we got grounded statewide, then we start going nationwide. And then it got serious because then the FBI started knocking on our door and the CIA. That's when we knew we were making a difference. That's when we knew people would follow us. But then we understood that our planning had gone as we expected. But we did that by talking to the elders. And I know there's this issue with, you know, age and all that going on. And old folks don't think the young folks are doing enough. And folks are just listening to hip-hop music and what have you. But we said we're going to extract everything we can from the elders that works. And then we're going to take it and blend it in with our excitement. And then we're going to build a movement from that. And so what we also learned, and this is so difficult, in building, we maintained a unified front. And it actually took Raza folks telling Black folks, don't put your business in the streets. Now, that's something that we have this little saying in the Black community. We believe, don't put your business in the streets. But actually, our business was all over the streets, all our little internal issues. And they said, we'll work with you if you clean up your stuff. And so it took our brothers and sisters in that organization to tell us that, and we learned how to build a united front and tell each other, okay, this is what's working and this is not what's working, so no one else could divide us. And then we kind of knew who our allies were. And this is the thing that people, I think, are missing today. You got to know, as you're building, you got to really know who your allies are. So some of us will go, well, I wanted Vice President such and so or Vice Chancellor such and so to be on our side. But once they're up there, their role is to watch over you and make sure you're staying in line. And so you got to learn how to use those people in positions and protect them so that you benefit each other. And so we learned that right on. And that's the piece that they didn't get. They didn't understand how we were as effective as we were. And so we kind of played that against them. And then you got to know when to pilot and to know when to trail. You know what I mean by that? You got to know when it's your time to be out front and when it's your time to be behind. And you have to rotate that, because if there's one group that's always in the front, you'll wear them out. And that's how they burn us out. Because when we finished, unfortunately, we ran because we were burnt out. But you have to exchange those roles so you always keep the energy going. And then you have to target the power players. Sometimes what we'll do is we'll target the people who don't even have the power. You got to look at who's pulling the strings, who has the power, and then you have to target them because they're the ones who can shift whatever needs to be shifted. And time management. And a lot of people go, oh, what do you mean time management? Time management is important because you have to know where and when and how to rejuvenate. You have to know that. Things that we used to do, and you guys got to figure it out for your generation, we'd have rent parties. I don't know if some of the old folks in here, the rent parties, like if somebody didn't have a lot of money, we throw a rent party, we got our groove on, right? We got some money, we fed some people, and then we gave the rent to the folks who needed it, folks who were out on the front line. And so that was our way of rejuvenating and then maintaining balance, whatever that is. If that's meditation, if that's reading, if that's quiet time, you have to maintain your balance, because you'll get to the point and you'll be looking yourself in the mirror and you'll be tired and you'll feel like a ghost. You've got to maintain balance. And that's the piece that we didn't get and we didn't learn until later on. And lastly, in terms of the things that are real important, you got to pass the torch. You can't get so busy that you don't pass the torch to the people coming behind you. You can't get so busy that you're not training the next group of people, if that's folks in high school, if that's freshmen, if you're a senior, however it is, you've got to train the next folks behind you, whoever you deem that is, because they've got to be prepared and they've got to be ready to implement. And a lot of times we get so stressed and so out of focus that we forget to pass the torch, and it's very difficult. Anybody out there run track? Anybody out there ever run track? You know, when you're running and you try to pass that torch, that's really difficult. It looks easy when you're watching it on TV, but you got to be on time. You got to be focused. You got to be able to be right there. And that's what it calls for. And that's kind of sort of my overall analysis for building, keeping, maintaining, and passing on the struggle to the next group. And I just, I like to do this in closing. I've kind of learn to just really go back and reflect on some of what our teachers share with us, because I think sometimes what we do is we forget that a whole bunch of struggles happen before us. And when we do that, we repeat the same old mistakes, and then we're just going in this cycle. We're going in, unfortunately, we're in this web. So I wanted to leave you with a few words of wisdom from my heroes, past and present. Because I believe that we must be grounded in the struggles of the past and use one another in the present moment to keep our spirit strong and our mind focused on the movement. And so what I do is I pull some thoughts from some people who helped me grow and help keep me grounded. And so we have, since our early struggles, not only experience, but we've really begun to understand the havoc and the devastation of oppression. We can see it all around. And so as a result, each one of us, at some point, we have stood on any and every platform and professed and insisted upon, fought and sweat for a simple word, and that's freedom. And in our struggle, we learned from Martin that freedom is never voluntary. It's never voluntarily given by the oppressor, and it must be demanded by the oppressed, right? So we understand what Biko meant when he said the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed, right? He got that, even though he had to get many beatings and scars and what have you to get that understanding. And that's why Harriet painstakingly revealed, I freed thousands of slaves, thousands, and I could have freed thousands more if they had known that they were slaves. But it was Malcolm's pragmatic voice stated plainly, we declare our right on this earth to be a human being. It's just that simple, to be a human being. To be given the rights of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day. And Angela teaches us that radical is not a dirty word, y'all. It's not a dirty word. It simply means grasping things at its root. So we place our hat in the ring because, as Arundhati Roy reveals, the world's freest country has the highest number of prisons. How free are we? And we know that the richest country can not only solve the homeless crisis, but fails to make it a priority. And it's still okay to the power brokers that some children go to school without any breakfast. And it's because Chomsky teaches us that all over the place, there's a constant pressure to make people, us, you and I, feel that we are helpless, that the only role we can have is to ratify the decisions and to consume. And even though it gets hard, I mean, we blink and there's Katrina. We sneeze and there's Darfur. And we sit down at our tables to eat and we realize that there are thousands, I mean thousands, suffering from the earthquake devastation in Asia. They, with no food, no shelter, and no family to lean on. And then we pull up our internet. A lot of us have the joy of having laptops. We pull up the internet, and on the highlights, it gives us the 10 most feared athletes, as if that's important. More important than the 45 million folks who don't have health care. 45 million folks in the United States of America who do not have health care. That there's a 50% dropout rate, high school dropout rate, in some of our inner cities. The fact that women and children are still the most disenfranchised and disregarded folks in the United States and all over the world. And that the passage of Proposition 209, and I watched that process, and its impact not only on the enrollment of folks of color, but on the cultural esteem of all of us, because that impacted every one of us. It impacts every one of us when you don't have diversity sitting right next to you in the classroom to help you think, to help you grow, to help you develop. That's what college is all about. That in 2005, 50 years after Brown versus Board, 60 years after Japanese internment, over 40 years after the work of Yuri, Malcolm, Rosa, Ella, Martin, Biko, Cesar, Mandela, we are still fighting the same doggone fight. Isn't that something? At times when it seems impossible to see progress, it seems so difficult to see progress in the same breath and in the same space, we're reminded what Malcolm said, that although we're still fighting the same struggle, stumbling is not falling, so the work has to continue. And it is because you and I are convinced, like Gandhi taught, the best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others. Because we believe what Arundhati Roy believes, another world is not only possible, that she is on her way, and on a quiet day we can hear her breathing. And for us who have made the choice, those of us in this room and in this space, it's just as obvious to all of us here as it was to Gandhi. We must be the change that we wish to see, right? So yesterday and today and tomorrow, I honorably and humbly accept my role as an activist and an educationalist, hopefully right alongside each one of you. Because I believe what Angela said when she said that the work of the political activist inevitably involves a certain tension between the requirement that a position be taken on current issues as they arise and the desire that one's contributions will somehow survive the ravages of our time. Your role today, until we can all walk, breathe, feel, and see freedom, is to query, is to investigate, and to determine what your ministry is in this world struggle for liberation and for peace. Because, folks, I am clear and convinced of what Fannie Lou Hamer's conviction was, that nobody, I mean nobody, under no uncertain terms, is free until everybody's free. Thank you.